Talk given Sunday, 15th
February 1981. The word karma is derived from the root kri, meaning fundamentally to create. And karma represents the living process of the entire universe. That is what karma really represents, the living process of the entire universe. And it's a living process which works out in accord with law. People have called it the law of karma, but they haven't taken sufficient count of what this law is actually called in India anyway. In the Rig Veda, we have this word Ritta, which means the fundamental and ultimate law of our being and our living. Ritta, R-I-T-A. Or if you want to be very accurate, R with the dot underneath it, which is pronounced Ri and T-A. Ritta. Our word right in both senses, R-I-T-E as well as R-I-G-H-T, is derived from Ritta. Now, this Ritta is something which is absolutely inherent in each and every single thing and person, everything that belongs to the living world as well as to what we have hitherto called the inanimate world throughout the cosmos. It is inherent in that. This is the important point. Therefore, it is a perpetual power working within things and within people without their knowing it usually. Now, another point to remember is that the word karma is associated with the idea of a divine justice which works through everything. Now, bear in mind carefully that karma represents the living process of the universe. And therefore, we must take into account that nothing is changeless. There is nothing immutable as far as the manifested universe is concerned. Everything undergoes change, and it undergoes change in accord with this inherent Ritta, this power which moves towards fruition and fulfillment. Therefore, we see that actually there is no such thing as a reaction which is an exact equivalence of a previous action. Ritta and karma function in terms of a transcendent context, not a limited context. Our limited context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal does not hinder the transcendent context of karma and Ritta operating through everything. If that were not the case, it would be difficult to see how there ever can be true fulfillment in the real sense, in the supreme sense. You know how the Buddha said, because there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade, etc. And he said, if there were not this unborn, unbecome, unmade, the transcendent, whose context is the infinite, the eternal and the immortal, there would be no release out of bondage to this here, which is the finite, the temporal and the mortal. You see? Now, this is of tremendous significance. Therefore, we must rule out the idea of karma operating in terms of exact equivalence throughout the universe. It does not operate, it does operate in terms of exact equivalence where material things are concerned. For instance, we all know about the law of gravitation. Gravitation measures the pull, the attractive pull upon all bodies, living or non-living. It measures that pull, and therefore we can weigh a body. And the weight of the body, unless there are changes in the structure and the constitution of the body, the weight of the body remains constant. Therefore, we have the possibility of a reaction and an action which are equal and opposite, Newton's third law and all that stuff, you see. But to apply our concept and our knowledge of Newton's third law to the living process of the whole universe, animate as well as inanimate, is a great mistake. You can't apply it. How are you going to measure the equivalence? A person performs some action here, which people say, oh, this is good and deserves a reward. Or they say, that is bad and deserves punishment. Well now, what will be the exact equivalence for the good thing and or the bad thing? How are we to measure it? There is no standard of measurement of goodness or badness. You see, this is of tremendous importance. We are so limited with our material experience. One 20 shillings for a pound note type of experience that we have, or that 1 pound of potatoes, the equivalent is so much, you see. All that kind of conditioning prevents us from being able to be sensitive and to appreciate what happens in the world of the living. And the entire world is living. We still use the word inanimate. I'm using the word inanimate. But that's really quite wrong now. Because just in recent years, scientifically, it has been shown that there is no such thing as dead matter. The entire universe is alive. What Rabindranath Tagore, the poet, many years ago, at the beginning of this century, I heard him say these words himself when he gave a talk. The ring dance of the atoms. The ring dance of the atoms. And he spoke in a way which gave the impression that he regarded atoms as being alive. As being alive. As growing, as changing, and so forth. So now, we cannot measure equivalence which we can mete out to goodness or badness. The fact is that everything undergoes this living process which is animated by Ritta, that fundamental power which moves all things to their proper fulfillment, which makes the rose bush bring out the perfect rose, the acorn grow into a perfect oak tree. A human being become truly human, completely human, and not remain subhuman. So now, how do we look at karma? How do we see divine justice? Remember how Aristotle put it. It is a very convenient way of understanding karma. The practice of virtue towards others. Now, consider the teachings which the great teachers gave. Teachers like Jesus and like the Buddha, for instance. If you look at the Sermon on the Mount, you will find... Which chapter is it? Chapter 5, I think, isn't it? Of Matthew. Wait a minute, I'll tell you. Yes, Matthew chapter 5 and starts, and particularly from verse 38 onwards, where he says that if a man smite thee on one cheek, give him, present the other to him. If a man would take thy jacket, give him thy cloak also, and so on, you see. If he would compel you to walk a mile, go with him 2 miles. And that is justice. The man of the world, unacquainted with the deeper aspect of things, would rebel against such things. This is what nonsense this is. Somebody does something harmful, something dreadful, and you want to sort of return some good for it, and so forth. Well, consider it carefully. A man compels you to go for a mile. Go with him 2 miles, said Jesus. During the walk of that second mile, it may be that something may happen, something may be said, which would completely alter the man's understanding and make him see deeply into things, may transform him, who knows? You see, these things are never thought of. So now, the practice of virtue was taught by Jesus as far as dealing with anything and anybody was concerned. The Buddha also taught similarly. If you read that discourse of his, study that discourse of his, the parable of the saw, as it is called, in which he says that if anybody were to speak harshly to you, do not speak harshly back at him, but let not your mind be perverted and feel enmity towards him. Let your mind be quiet and full of friendliness towards him. And starting with him, suffuse him with loving kindness, and then the teacher, your teacher, your loved ones, your so-called enemies, and then the whole world, suffuse the whole world with loving kindness. Now this is particularly significant. You see how in presenting this sort of teaching, the Buddha takes the whole question of karma and justice completely out of the sphere of the mechanical, the 20 shillings, 1 pound. Yes, that's right. The 20 shillings, 1 pound correspondence. Takes it completely out of that sphere, you see, and lifts it to the transcendent sphere, as far as the vision of what sort of action should come from us is concerned, takes it into the transcendent sphere, and thereby what happens? You heal the other person. Justice is not concerned, karma is not concerned with rewarding good and punishing evil. This is where we have made a colossal blunder in trying to understand karma. Because as I said earlier on, you cannot really find the proper equivalence at all. It is concerned with healing, with whole-making, releasing man into his true holiness, which is his full humanity. It is a completely different conception. And in the case of the great spiritual teachers, it was a realized fact for them. They could do that, they did do that, and thereby set going into the world those influences for improvement and betterment which have borne fruit in some way or other throughout the centuries. Consider a situation like this. We have invented the atomic bomb, and that was 30 years ago, or 1945, let me see, that's 35 years ago, it was used. With what consequences? 100,000 people were slain just like that, at once. 100,000 people. Now, people who hold the old view of karma, that, this was their karma, the karma of 100,000 people. Do you think that holds water? Can you imagine that? How is it that 100,000 people came to be born as Japanese people who lived in that town Hiroshima at the time when the atomic bomb was dropped? I completely reject any such explanation, as it was their karma. That is to say, it was the horror due to them for their past wrongdoing. Absolutely not. Completely reject that. Even though it may have the authority of no less exalted a person than a Buddha. They were not responsible for that. This is how things happen. Remember that through time there is this process of development, this process of opening out, coming to fruition. So everything in that process becomes intensified, becomes bigger and bigger. And therefore, what man does to man has a much greater quantity attached to it. In the old days, they only had primitive weapons. Today we have these weapons. A modern hydrogen bomb in half a second will absolutely annihilate 3 million people. Now it's no good saying that in this particular town which is to be annihilated by the hydrogen bomb, 3 million people, 3 million people's karma brought them there. It didn't do anything of the sort. And you see, it also implies a belief in this peculiar idea of reincarnation. And it implies, therefore, the acceptance that this psychophysical organism, which represents the living person, that this psychophysical organism has some entity element in it which is immortal, which goes on from life to life. Either an entity element, or you can try to wish-wash it by saying, character goes on, or your karma goes on. How can you say your karma goes on as such? An action which takes place in the immediate now, and its ripples, like ripples on the surface of a pond, they may go off until that energy is completely lost. It's gone forever. The manifested world knows death in the real sense. The particular manifestation completely disappears. And you know the Buddhist analysis of the individual being in terms of the rupa, the shape or form, the vedana, the feelings, the sanya, the thoughts and ideas, the sankhara, psychological conformations and so forth, and vijnana, discriminative consciousness. Not a single one of them is permanent. And all of them exist together in a simultaneity in the living person. This is what we forget. When Buddhists talk about these matters, they do not take sufficient account of the fact that all these different khandhas exist together. If one of them really disappears, all the rest disappear with it. It's like a house of cards, it's like a pack of cards arranged in such a way that they all stand up in a pattern. Let any one of them be pushed out and the whole lot will fall down. You see, we have to go deeply into these things, look very critically and very carefully to understand what happens. There is no entity which carries on after the death of the psychophysical organism. The whole thing is gone. So you see, where justice is concerned, we'll come back to this point about the atom bomb. You can see that it is extremely difficult to give credence to the idea that so many millions of people or so many hundreds of thousands of people's karma led them to that particular place to be at that particular instant there to be the subject of destruction like that. There's another aspect to it. You and I, all of us, we are finite mortal beings. We are limited beings. We are capable of actions which are good, which are not so good, but to what extent are we capable of good actions? And what is the extent of that goodness? Or bad actions, and what is the extent of that badness? Can I, a finite, limited mortal, perform an action which deserves, as the people who believe in karma say, you deserved it, you've brought it on yourself. Can I perform any limited action or even 100,000 limited actions of such terrible enormity as to deserve the complete annihilation by an atomic bomb? Look at it another way. Those religions which propound heavens and hells, everlasting hell. Can I, a temporal, finite, mortal being, do anything that would deserve an eternal hell? I ask you. It's not possible for me to deserve it, to do anything which could deserve such a thing. So you see, we must rewrite our understanding of the working of the law of karma. No single individual can do a thing like that. What actually happens is something different. Consider carefully. Here is this primordial creative energy which, functioning in acting in eternity, throws up a cosmos. Do remember that the primordial creative energy has for its context the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. And by its own self-limitation, it produces innumerable separate things and various processes which ultimately on a planet like ours has released human beings as such. Now, this process, as it goes on, produces change, but change towards a state of fulfillment. Consciousness is one of the most powerful factors in our life and in our progress and so forth. If we are really conscious of something, the brain will not know it. Now that's a curious thing to say. You'll say, how on earth is that possible? The brain does not need to know it then. Because whatsoever you are truly conscious of happens with you naturally and spontaneously. You don't have to pay attention to it lest it may go wrong. To put it in another form, you know it so well that it just follows automatically. Have you watched your concert artist performing, your great concert artist? He's absolutely lost in it, isn't he? He doesn't need to bother about it. Look at your great poet, your great sculptor and thing. It just happens. Now this is the one of the extraordinary things about consciousness, that we start off with vijnana, discriminative consciousness, separating this from that and so on, and then we know how to put the parts together and make a whole. But that is a mechanical synthesis. Any true creation is a live integration, which is completely different from a mechanical synthesis. This we must clearly understand. So now, this primordial creative energy finally brings us into being as such. And this primordial creative energy is perpetually at work. It never ceases. And it works not continuously in the way that a river flows along and you see it as a continuous stream. It flows like the way in which quantum energy acts. It goes in pulses all the time. And therefore it is a discontinuous activity. It's rather difficult to talk about this accurately, because discontinuous implies context of limitation. In the context of limitation, you can get continuity. In the context of the unlimited, you can't get continuity in our sense of the word. And it is discontinuous, and it is non-repetitive. That is to say, from split second to split second, whatsoever it throws out is new. The universe as a whole appears to remain the same for us, because our sensitivities and our modes of apprehension are incapable of keeping pace with this creative activity of the primordial creative energy. I'm using this term because we live in a modern age, in a scientific age, and the word energy has come to play the most important part in the whole system. In the old days, we would have used the word God or Brahman or something like that. Now, remember what Sri Krishna said in the Gita. He's talking to Arjuna and he says, Arjuna, if I did not engage perpetually in action, constantly, if I did not engage constantly in action, these worlds would fall into ruin. Now this action is creative action of this primordial creative energy. Krishna is believed by the Hindus as God himself, not merely son of God or just an avatara, but God himself manifesting in flesh. And Krishna says these words. There was no real Krishna as such. It's the author of the Gita who, realizing the profoundest meditative state, understood what it meant to be the perfected human whose consciousness is in complete step with this creative activity of the primordial creative energy. It's in complete rhythm with it. And therefore he knows what he's talking about. And he is, the author of the Gita really, is Sri Krishna. You will find a verse in the Gita which gives the secret away. I've quoted it in my chapter on the Gita, In the Heart of Religion. You look it up, you'll find it. Is right on the first page. The author of the Gita is himself Arjuna. Arjuna represents man in the ordinary everyday state. And Krishna represents man in that supreme meditative state, the completely fulfilled state of a perfected holiness, of perfected humanity. And he says, therefore, the author of the Gita says, if I did not engage constantly in action, these worlds would fall into ruin. Of course, the devout Hindu believes that action here means, you know, getting up in the morning, saying his, doing his meditation, going through his ablutions, having breakfast and seeing to this, to that and the other, and all the jobs that he has to do, all the daily chores. That's what he means by action. Sri Krishna means the activity of this primordial creative energy, but because of which the entire universe subsists. That is the meaning of that statement in the Gita. And nobody has ever put that out. It's extraordinary how that has never been presented as such. And he also says that being and non-being am I, death am I, and the origin of all things to come. Now, what is the implication of that? This primordial creative energy is being and non-being. It is being when the energy acting in eternity throws out a whole cosmos as such. Then innumerable beings come into manifestation. Isn't that the case? There isn't just one being, just you or I or your pet cat or dog or anything. There are innumerable beings. They all come into existence as such. And remember, existence means standing out of. Ex sistere. Sistere to stand. Ex out of. We stand out of the context of this primordial creative energy, the absolute, which is perpetually at work. All right. So existence, we come into existence as such. So Krishna says, being, meaning all the innumerable beings, and he says in other parts of the Gita that he is the all, all beings and non-being. Now, beings are separate and many, limited and so forth. Non-being, what is non-being? You see, we have a negative concept of non-being. We think that it is the annihilation, the complete extermination of being. No, non-being is a reality. A positive reality, just as being is a positive reality for us. Non-being is a positive reality, but with this difference. The being is finite, particular, limited. Non-being is the infinite, unlimited. There can be only one non-being. It is that ultimate absolute out of which everything, all the unabsolutes, come out. You get the idea? So now, this is the karmic process. So that all of us, as we continuously come out, are expressions, pressed out of. We are expressions of that one and only supreme absolute, which you may call supreme being, if you like. In the Upanishads, this is presented as Brahman. And Brahman has the subtitle, if you like, Sat-Chit-Ananda. Sat, being, manifestation. Chit, complete attentiveness, perfect attentiveness. Arjuna, if I did not engage in action and you can't engage in action without attending to action, you see, the worlds would fall into ruin. Sat, being, chit, attention, attentiveness, ananda, bliss. Instead of attentiveness, you can use the word pure consciousness, absolute consciousness, if you like. You see? And bliss. These three are absolutely inherent in the ultimate, whatever that ultimate may be. The Buddha's unborn, unbecome, unmade, or call it Brahman, or whatever you please. So the karmic process is this universal process starting, emerging out of the transcendent context of the infinite, the eternal and the immortal, manifesting as beings who are finite, temporal and mortal. And mortality implies all the duals, pain, pleasure, joy, sorrow, and it also implies decay, aging, death, grief, and all the rest of it, doesn't it? Mortality implies all that. So now, in beings, consciousness comes to flower ultimately if they live religiously. This is the important point. Consciousness does not change, does not really grow merely through the acquisition of knowledge in the worldly sense. The knowledge of things, of electronics and algebra and whatever it is. You see, it does not flower out. It flowers out through living the pure moral life. All the world teachers of the world have that point in common in their teaching. Every single one of them. What did they teach apart from telling you to live the pure life? They did not go into. They did not produce great philosophical tomes or political or economic systems or sociological panaceas or anything like that. They were quite unconcerned with that because they knew that if you and I, the individual, will live this pure life, we ourselves will be sources of those energies which will transform our institutions and everything and change the world. But if we go rushing into the world as it is and try to change it, well, what we generally succeed in doing is to impose our shortcomings and absurdities upon the world and bring about very little change for the better. We do bring about some change, but nothing really worthwhile. Whereas it is the great spiritual teachers who, having realized the ultimate for themselves, are able to do this. So now, in the living of the pure life, in the living of the real, of the religious life, in the true sense, the actual living from moment to moment, from day to day, there is justice manifested, divine justice. Now notice one peculiar feature of this divine justice. If you or I, or if you and I live the pure life, the good life, we suffer for it. Look, John Brown is a very good man and lives a truly pure life, a truly holy life. Supposing his friends, people of the world, tell him, "Oh, come and join us at the pub tonight." And he goes. And these three or four friends and he will be together there. And there'll be 30 or 40 other people in the pub, won't there? Now, supposing he's introduced to those people and they come to know something about John Brown. Do you think they'll like him? They'll dislike him. He's not one of us. He's not like us. He's a strange fellow, curious chap. Now, this was wonderfully exemplified in the life of Jesus. Consider the life of Jesus very carefully. And remember, Jesus said, Jesus taught, "Be ye perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." I mean, that's a terrific thing to say altogether. It's the hint given to mankind that you and the absolute truth, the ultimate truth, are one and same, and the same. In you, in potentiality, are one with that perfection. You see? All right, what happened to Jesus? He was ultimately crucified. suffered agony. Have you ever thought of what sort of suffering that is? Use your imagination. You have no idea what it is like. But this was justice in relationship to Jesus. It was quite just that he should be crucified. You see, the justice doesn't lie so much in the actual event as such. The justice lies in the relationships which come into being as a result of the event, and the influence upon all mankind afterwards. Well, when Jesus was crucified, people thought that, here is a case of failure. But see what has happened in the course of 20 centuries. If anything, Christendom has shown many points of failure, undoubtedly. The inquisitions and the wars in the name of religion and the horrible things that have been done. And they have been done in the name of justice, funnily enough. You know how right up till the end of the 19th century, practically, children were hanged for stealing a loaf of bread. Prostitutes and vagrants were publicly flogged. Quakers, because they were Quakers, were treated in the same way with ghastly cruelty. The history of man is a really sorry tale. It's a terrible tale. But divine justice works in this peculiar way. It includes martyrdom. It includes suffering for the sake of other people. Take our word compassion. Karuna, as we call it. And you know how in Buddhism it is said that the path of a Buddha is filled with unutterable woe. Don't forget that. It's filled with unutterable woe. Take the word compassion. Passion means to suffer. From passio, the Latin. I suffer, you see. And com is together with. I suffer together with the suffering of my fellow human beings. And because I suffer with their suffering, therefore there is this perfect relationship of one profound aspect of love, the Mahakaruna. This is justice, because in that suffering, with the suffering of others, I do unto them that which will help them, which will heal them, make them whole, lead them into the ways of holiness. And this is the important thing. Lead them into the ways of holiness. And therefore, this compassion has to be associated with wisdom. Because unless you are wise, your compassion will be misapplied. Pity and all that sort of thing is considerably misapplied. How many people salve their conscience by giving a £100,000 check for some great charity in order to help the poor and the miserable and so on? How many do that? A good few do and have done through the course of history. But that is not compassion. You look at it, you look at these things very, very carefully. Go deeply into it. Really go deeply into it. Meditate on the true meaning of the word karma. Creative action in eternity. That is the fundamental meaning of the word karma. And see how in the working out of karma, there is the working out of justice in the true sense. What did the great teachers teach? The practice of virtue towards everybody, didn't they? That is what they taught. When the Buddha said, suffuse the other person, whether he be a right doer or a wrong doer, that's neither here nor there. It doesn't matter. Suffuse that person with loving kindness, with compassion, with sympathetic joy, and with imperturbability, upekkha, complete poise, inward balance. The business of justice is not to reward the good doer and to punish the evil doer, but the business of justice is to heal, make whole, make holy everything and everybody. Everything is sacred because everything has come out of the ultimate source of all sanctity. Therefore, everything is holy potentially, and our task is to cooperate with that. And then there is justice in the true sense, and there is the true expression of karma. And what comes to the individual himself? Although the path of a Buddha is filled with unutterable woe, although the Christian is crucified for the sake of suffering with others, for the good that he does, although that is the case, inwardly, in one's innermost consciousness, there is the great peace. The sublime, unoriginated nirvana is there. And this is the meaning of bliss. It's not pleasure, it's not joy, it is bliss, something utterly indescribable. It's ananda, lovely word in the in the Sanskrit language. Ananda, the very sound of it is musical and beautiful. And I hope that if we are able to consider karma this way, we will be free of so many misconceptions connected with it.